Remarks of the President to the first graduating class of the Vietnam Foreign Service Institute Training Center from the Rose Garden of the White House, the 21st of March, 1968.
Ambassador Allen, most distinguished graduates, ladies and gentlemen. Today, those of you that have gathered here at the White House set out as warriors for peace. I ask you to come here because I want all the people of America to know of your particular mission. You must expect that your efforts will go largely unreported. Your progress is going to be harder to see and harder to measure. But the victories you win are the ones on which peace will be built in Vietnam. Let no one misread our purpose. Peace is our goal. Let no one mistake our resolve. Peace will be won. It will be peace with honor. It will be a peace in which the people of South Vietnam will be free to live the lives they choose to live. Peace will come because brave men and free men are preventing aggressors from taking a neighbor's land by force. Peace will come because men like you are willing to help the people of South Vietnam forge a free nation. It will come because those beleaguered people themselves, after a century of colonialism and a generation of war, have not broken before the enemy's terror. There is a deep and a quiet courage among millions of simple people in Vietnam. It goes largely unreported. The stories of the farmers, the stories of the teachers in the schools, the stories of the students and the mothers and the fathers and the families who sacrifice and struggle go unnoticed in the anguish of war. But when the enemy unleashed his savage attack over the Tet Holidays, he thought that he would crack the will of the Vietnamese people. But he was wrong. He did not crack the will of the students in the high school in Quang Nam. Instead, they turned out in a body to volunteer for the emergency work reconstructing. He did not crack the will of the citizens of Hong Song District in Saigon, who fought the Viet Cong with sticks, or the nurses near Berea who hid a Korean medical team while the enemy occupied their hospital for more than 30 hours. Stories like these were repeated up and down this ravaged land. We did not read about them. The enemy attack is what got the headlines. But in Vietnam, there were heroes by the hundreds that dark week that were unseen and were unsung. And their actions spoke for a free people that are determined to find their own way into their own future. Their will did not, as expected, break under the fire. Neither shall ours break under frustration. Peace will come to Vietnam. The terror of an invading enemy will be turned back. The work of reconstruction will go on, and a nation will rise strong and free. And I think that Each of you standing here on the White House steps today will be proud to say that you were there, that you were a part of helping a struggling people come into their own, participate in self-determination, and become a part of liberty and freedom in the world. I think you'll be proud to say that you were there, because you will be the builders of the peace. I'm honored to greet you this morning.
The President's remarks to a group of editorial cartoonists in the East Room of the White House, the 18th of May, 1968.
Mr. Poirier, ladies and gentlemen, my friends and fellow crusaders. Be perfectly frank and honest with you, I'm very surprised to see you here on Saturday afternoon. I think it's a wonderful day, though, for America when the press demonstrates such a very high sense of responsibility. By choosing to watch the president instead of the Preakness. This has been an extraordinary day for me. I waked up with my favorite New York morning paper, the New York Times, and saw my wife below the Statue of Liberty and standing stand between a Republican governor that's a candidate for my job and a Republican mayor who's candidate for somebody's job. There she was, penned by two Republicans, and I took my nap this afternoon, got ready, prepared to come see you, and I saw where my son-in-law was pinned down by some Viet Cong. And I'm deeply touched that you should come here and pay this extraordinary tribute to me, a man who on March 31st declared himself as an early scratch. I hope you lovely ladies will let me share some of this credit with your husband, who could have been at the racetrack. I may have saved all of you some housekeeping money, who knows. I also hope that my reassessment has not caused any commotion in your households. I understand that some of you gentlemen may be thinking of changing your occupations too. You'll have to turn in your drawing pads, because you're going to miss me that much. All of me. My button nose. My cute ears. My big 10-gallon hat and my big black snake whip. I've always envied you your freedom of expression. You are the living proof of the wonders of democracy, where one man's artistic license is another man's credibility gap. So I'm going to miss you too. Though it will be nice to bite into my morning Texas grapefruit without you biting back in your morning newspaper. But we will not be too far apart. I think some of you may know that a collection of your work spanning all the years of my public life will be on display in the Johnson Library at the University of Texas. It has been assembled by an impartial panel of experts, Marvin Watson, and Jack Valenti. Governor John Connally, my cousin Oriole, Patrick Lyndon Nugent, and Yuki as the tiebreaker. The family had no trouble finding a title for this historic volume. It will be called In Cold Blood. I suppose, though, I could have had it worse. After all, I could have been up against a columnist with all of your talent. Thank goodness Walter Lippmann never learned to draw. Some of you may remember what Boss Teed said when Thomas Nast was crusading against him. He said, "I don't care what they print about me. Most of my constituents can't read anyhow. But them damn pictures." Well, most of my constituents can read. A modern president gets both barrels from the press. And I've learned something from you cartoonists. You have taught me that there are some virtues to being a Republican. It must be wonderful to belong to a party that offers you the natural protection of an elephant hide. Yes, you are teachers, and your talents and traditions are unique. You're quite in the American tradition. The best of your art is innovation, a creative and constant search for the truth to lead us on. I like your imagination and your humor, even if I don't like the characters that you select for it sometimes. The greatest of your skills are those that you sharpen against the whetstone of argument and controversy, those that serve as the cutting edge of democratic dialogue and the destiny of free men. There are some who say you are at your best when you're most angry, or I think sometimes just downright cruel. I disagree. Your talent and your tradition are much too precious to be spent in just negative and destructive purpose. I believe that you will continue to make constructive use of your gifts. The best memories that you've given me for all of my life are those that I hope that your profession will continue to give this nation all of its life. Humor, understanding, courage, compassion, faith, and the best of all, your wit. Ms. Johnson is sorry that she cannot be here this afternoon. She is, I think, this week broken a record that Ms. Roosevelt established after some 4 terms in the White House, where Ms. Johnson has had the help of a jet instead of an iron horse. There's something about this house that women don't like to stay in it all the time, I've observed. And we are glad, though, that some of you women who are here for your first time can spend a part of your weekend with us. We hope you enjoy your trip. We've enjoyed seeing you, and I'll have a chance to say hello to some of you in the next room. Thank you very much.
I want to thank President Johnson for his kindness to us, and I want to present for all of you this collection of the cartoons which were drawn on the day that he withdrew from the 1968 presidential race. We hope they will make a nice addition to his collection. And Mr. Milton Morris, our treasurer here, has a drawing on which every member of the organization has added his signature, and we thought you might like to add that to your collection.
Is Miss Willie Day Taylor here? Where are you, Willie Day? Willie Day is the one of the best things that's happened to our life. I mean, all of the Johnsons. She raised both of my daughters, and she's stood by watching with my wife, and she's nursed me all through the years, and thank goodness, with your help, she has collected, I think, the most unusual collection of cartoons of any person in public life. And I want to thank her again for her dedication through the years, and I want to thank all of you for not just your talents, but your generosity and the trouble that you've gone to help her help me.
The President's remarks at a ceremony presenting the Presidential Unit Citation to the 26th Marines 3rd Division, the Cabinet Room of the White House, the 23rd of May, 1968.
Secretary Ignatius, General Watson, Congressman Brooks, General Chapman, Colonel Lowndes, Sergeant Major Smith, ladies and gentlemen. It was 23 years ago that the 26 Marines took part in a mission that some people believe to be impossible, the capture of Iwo Jima, the most heavily fortified island in all the world. That mission was accomplished, and the 26, after being awarded a Presidential Unit Citation for its part in that battle, passed from the active roles of the Marine Corps on into history. In January of 1966, the 26 was reborn as the 1st Regiment of the reactivated 5th Marine Division. Again, the colors of the 26 Marines were carried into our fight for freedom in Asia. Again, they were assigned a task believed by many to be impossible. Reinforced with a battalion from a sister regiment, the 1st Battalion, 9th Marine, and joined by a battalion of valiant South Vietnamese Rangers, the 26 was given the job of defending the vital combat base at Khe Sanh. The 6,000 Allied troops faced more than 20,000 determined North Vietnamese. Some say there are no North Vietnamese in that area. But in the face of this threat, after most mature deliberation here, we asked General Westmoreland for his judgment about whether we should hold the position or remove our forces. He was told to give no thought to the psychological or political repercussions of withdrawal in the United States. The judgment of this battlefield general differed considerably from that of some here at home,
who then predicted that Khe Sanh would be another Dien Bien Phu. General Westmoreland's decision was that the base should and could and would be held. And that decision was confirmed by the Joint Chiefs and other officials here. His faith in the 26 Marines was more than justified. For more than 70 days and nights, they held, despite massive and merciless attacks by the enemy. The North Vietnamese mounted an assault identical to that which ended in their victory at Dien Bien Phu 14 years ago. But they had not counted on the most overwhelming, intelligent, and effective use of air power in the history of warfare. Nor had they counted on the courage and the endurance and the artillery of the Marines at Khe Sanh. So unable to conquer, they at the moment withdrew. Some have asked what the gallantry of these Marines and airmen accomplished. Why did we choose to pay the price to defend those dreary hills? The fortress at Khe Sanh straddled critical supply and infiltration routes that the North Vietnamese were using. Route 9, which it commanded, was to be a major avenue for the enemy into populated areas and into the cities of South Vietnam. By pinning down and by decimating two North Vietnamese divisions, the few thousand Marines and their gallant South Vietnamese allies prevented those divisions from entering other major battles, such as those for Hue and Quang Tri. I believe that our initiative toward talks with North Vietnam was greatly strengthened by what these men did at Khe Sanh, for they vividly demonstrated to the enemy the utter futility of his attempts to win a military victory in the South. All of us in America hope that the road to peace will lead through the talks in Paris. But it is still not clear that Hanoi is ready for an early or an honorable peace. The flow of infiltrators and of equipment from North Vietnam has never been greater than it is now. There is still very bitter fighting in many areas of South Vietnam. There has been no visible lessening of Hanoi's aggressive efforts. In fact, Hanoi is today telling its forces in the South that they must continue their offensive to support their negotiators in Paris. For our part, we shall seriously and soberly pursue negotiations toward an honorable and peaceful settlement of this war. But this should also be clear. We shall not be defeated on the battlefield while the talks go on. We shall not permit the enemy's mortars and rockets to go unanswered and to permit him to achieve a victory that would make a mockery of the negotiations. We have faith that an honorable peace can be achieved in Vietnam. But if there must be more fighting before it comes, then we shall not be found wanting. Brave men such as the 26th Marine will carry on the fight for freedom in Vietnam. And soon, God willing, they will come home. We would like nothing more than to see that day. But until they do, we shall express at moments such as these, on behalf of all
our American people our great gratitude for the protection they have given us and our great appreciation for their selfless bravery. The Secretary of the Navy will now read the citation.
The President's remarks at the Congressional Medal of Honor presentation to Army Sergeant David C. Dolby, the East Room of the White House, the 28th of September, 1967.
Secretary Rezor, General Haines, members of the Congress, distinguished guests, the Dolby family, Sergeant Dolby, we've come here this morning to honor one of America's bravest men. In presenting Sergeant David Dolby with the nation's highest award, we bear witness to a courage and a dedication that rests well above and far beyond the call of duty. To this soldier, valor is a familiar companion. He is a member of the 1st Cavalry, the remarkable division to whom I had the honor of presenting a presidential unit citation just earlier this month. He already holds several medals, including a Purple Heart and a Silver Star, and yet he just recently turned 21 years of age. We are proud that such men still march under the American colors. But for all of our pride in Sergeant Dolby, this is a day for sorrow as well. Sorrow that in a world that boasts of its progress and its civilization, heroism and sacrifice on the battlefields still seem to be necessary. We who have labored all of our lives to preserve and to enrich human life in our own country and abroad grieve that young Americans must go out to the frontier of freedom and fight, taking the lives of others while risking their own. I am often asked, why do you say so little in reply to the critics of the war? The answer is simple. No one hates war and killing more than I do. No sane American can greet the news from Vietnam with enthusiasm. Indeed, an American who rejoiced in war and conflict should be instantly removed from any position. But in the same sense, we cannot cheer as we learn of the impact of our might on the enemy. In the spirit of Abraham Lincoln, we must confront our obligations with dedication and with resolution, and we must be moved by anguish and compassion at the consequences. We recognize and have always recognized that there can be no simple military solution to the problems of Southeast Asia. But we have also had to face the hard reality that only military power can bar aggression and can make a political solution possible. We wish for nothing more than a swift and honorable resolution of our differences in Vietnam. We have offered to talk anytime, anywhere. But until there is a response that might lead to a just political settlement, we must and we will fight to prevent others from imposing their military solution on the people of South Vietnam and Southeast Asia. Until the day comes when we lay down our arms and we deal in good faith with North Vietnam across the conference table, brave young men like David Dolby will have to fight in order to assure others their freedom. They are the finest of America's manhood. As Winston Churchill wrote, courage is rightly esteemed the first of human qualities because it is the quality which guarantees all others. We cherish that quality in you, Sergeant Dolby, and we shall redeem that guarantee. We are so proud that your parents and your family can be here with you today. We know that they, too, are so proud of you. Secretary Rezor will now read Sergeant Dolby's citation.
Part one of the President's Address to the American People. From the President's Office, March 31st, 1968.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. Tonight I want to speak to you of peace in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. No other question so preoccupies our people. No other dream so absorbs the 250 million human beings who live in that part of the world. No other goal motivates American policy in Southeast Asia. For years, representatives of our governments and others have traveled the world seeking to find a basis for peace talks. Since last September, they have carried the offer that I made public at San Antonio. And that offer was this: that the United States would stop its bombardment of North Vietnam when that would lead promptly to productive discussions, and that we would assume that North Vietnam would not take military advantage of our restraint. Hanoi denounced this offer both privately and publicly. Even while the search for peace was going on, North Vietnam rushed their preparations for a savage assault on the people, the government, and the allies of South Vietnam. Their attack during the Tet holidays failed to achieve its principal objective. It did not collapse the elected government of South Vietnam or shatter its army as the communists had hoped. It did not produce a general uprising among the people of the cities as they had predicted. The communists were unable to maintain control of any of the more than 30 cities that they attacked, and they took very heavy casualties. But they did compel the South Vietnamese and their allies to move certain forces from the countryside into the cities. They caused widespread disruption and suffering. Their attacks and the battles that followed made refugees of 500,000 human beings. The communists may renew their attack any day. They are, it appears, trying to make 1968 the year of decision in South Vietnam, the year that brings, if not final victory or defeat, at least a turning point in the struggle. This much is clear. If they do mount another round of heavy attacks, they will not succeed in destroying the fighting power of South Vietnam and its allies. But tragically, this is also clear. Many men on both sides of the struggle will be lost. A nation that has already suffered 20 years of warfare will suffer once again. Armies on both sides will take new casualties, and the war will go on. There is no need for this to be so. There is no need to delay the talks that could bring an end to this long and this bloody war. Tonight, I renew the offer I made last August to stop the bombardment of North Vietnam. We ask that talks begin promptly, that they be serious talks on the substance of peace. We assume that during those talks, Hanoi will not take advantage of our restraint. We are prepared to move immediately toward peace through negotiations. So tonight, in the hope that this action will lead to early talks, I am taking the first step to de-escalate the conflict.
we are reducing, substantially reducing, the present level of hostilities. And we are doing so unilaterally and at once. Tonight, I have ordered our aircraft and our naval vessels to make no attacks on North Vietnam, except in the area north of the demilitarized zone where the continuing enemy buildup directly threatens Allied forward positions and where the movement of their troops and supplies are clearly related to that threat. The area in which we're stopping our attacks includes almost 90% of North Vietnam's population and most of its territory. Thus, there will be no attacks around the principal populated areas or in the food-producing areas of North Vietnam. Even this very limited bombing of the North could come to an early end if our restraint is matched by restraint in Hanoi. But I cannot, in good conscience, stop all bombing so long as to do so would immediately and directly endanger the lives of our men and our allies. Whether a complete bombing halt becomes possible in the future will be determined by events. Our purpose in this action is to bring about a reduction in the level of violence that now exists. It is to save the lives of brave men and to save the lives of innocent women and children. It is to permit the contending forces to move closer to a political settlement. And tonight I call upon the United Kingdom and I call upon the Soviet Union as co-chairman of the Geneva conferences and as permanent members of the United Nations Security Council to do all they can to move from the unilateral act of de-escalation that I have just announced toward genuine peace in Southeast Asia. Now, as in the past, the United States is ready to send its representatives to any forum at any time to discuss the means of bringing this ugly war to an end. I am designating one of our most distinguished Americans, Ambassador Averill Harriman, as my personal representative for such talks. In addition, I have asked Ambassador Llewellyn Thompson, who returned from Moscow for consultation, to be available to join Ambassador Harriman at Geneva or any other suitable place just as soon as Hanoi agrees to a conference. I call upon President Ho Chi Minh to respond positively and favorably to this new step toward peace. But if peace does not come now through negotiations, it will come when Hanoi understands that our common resolve is unshakable and our common strength is invincible. Tonight, we and the other allied nations are contributing 600,000 fighting men to assist 700,000 South Vietnamese troops in defending their little country. Our presence there has always rested on this basic belief. The main burden of preserving their freedom must be carried out by them, by the South Vietnamese themselves. We and our allies can only help to provide a shield behind which the people of South Vietnam can survive and can grow and develop. On their efforts, on their determinations and resourcefulness, the outcome will ultimately depend. That small, beleaguered nation has suffered terrible punishment for more than 20 years. I pay tribute once again tonight to the great courage and the endurance of its people.